and welcome to the second book talk in our series of events commemorating the First World War, in partnership with the Davis County Public Library and OCTC. I'm Jennifer Joe, faculty librarian here at WKU's Owensboro campus. We're joined tonight by our other committee members, Kevin Dorth, also from WKU Owensboro, and Angela Ash from OCTC. Leslie McCarthy from the DCPL could not be here tonight. A native New Yorker, our speaker tonight is a graduate of Harvard University. She received a PhD with a specialization in Russian and Soviet history from the University of Michigan in 1994 and joined the faculty of the History Department at the University of Kentucky in that same year. Her first major monograph, Life Has Become More Joyous, Comrades, Celebrations in the Time of Stalin, was published by Indiana University Press in 2000 as part of its series in Russian and Eastern European Studies. In it, she used previously inaccessible Soviet archives to explore how Soviet Union in the 1930s, public celebrations were more than a mere diversion, but rather a part of a reward system that valorized some citizens as the best people of the Soviet Union, while encouraging others to follow the example of these heroes. In her second major work, The Great War in Russian Memory, published in 2011 by Indiana University Press, she uses memoirs, literature, films, military histories, and archival materials to show that World War I, while never officially commemorated, was the subject of a lively discourse about religion, heroism, violence, and patriotism during the interwar period. In November 2013, Karen received the Help Prize for the Best Book by a Woman in Slavic East European Eurasian Studies at the annual meeting of the Association for Slavic East European and Eastern Eurasian Studies Convention in Boston. She's contributed articles for the Encyclopedia of Russian History, including one frequently cited on Lenin's tomb. Her newest publications include a chapter called Models of Selfhood and Subjectivity, The Soviet Case in Historical Perspective in Mass Dictatorship and Modernity, published in November 2013, and Everyday Life in Russia Past and Present, due out this spring, Indiana University Press. She's a professor and department chair of history at the University of Kentucky, where she recently taught a new class, Reimagining Russia, as part of UK's Passport to the World series. Students reviewing her class noted, she's brilliant in the classroom. Please welcome Karen Patron.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the committee very much. Jennifer, thank you. And also thanks to Kevin Dorth, who's one of my former students. But many thanks to the whole committee for inviting me and for the folks at WKU Libraries, and the dean and Dr. Kutz. Anyway, and everyone else on the committee. Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here. I'm going to put the lights on so that I can see my paper. Okay. So today, my specialization is Russian history, Russian and Soviet history, and World War I memory is often forgotten in Russian history. And tonight, I'm going to do some comparative work looking at World War I in American history, where, in fact, many scholars argue that it, too, is also forgotten. And so this is an interesting sort of question. It's a parallel. I'm much more an expert on the Soviet side, but I wanted to bring in the American side to think about this question. And I also wanted to think about, well, why are we all here? Why did you organize this series on World War I? What was the reason that you did it?
Because it's the
100th anniversary.
And deserve to be recognized.
Okay. So in some sense, we are in this room at the moment actually participating in the same phenomenon that I'm describing, right? We are all called together here today, and the date was actually even supposed to be next week, even closer to Armistice Day, but unfortunately I needed to come this week instead. And we're all here because 100 years ago in July, World War I began. And so we too are participating in this culture of remembrance, whether we realized it or not when we walked in the room. And so it's 100 years since the start of the war. It's 96 years since the armistice on 11/11. And they signed it at 11/11 on 11/11. So I don't know. My kids always make a wish when the clock goes to 11:11. I think it might come back to that, ending of the war in 1918. I'm not sure. I'm not a folklorist, but there are experts in the room on folklore who might be able to answer that. So here we are trying to figure out, you know, sort of this event, this really world-changing event, happened 100 years ago. And it was remembered differently in different places. So I have my outline here. And the first thing I want to talk to you about before we really get into either of these remembrances is, well, why is war memory important? Why do we care about it? It turns out that war memory is something that, first off, is not static, right? It changes over time. I'm an historian, and the most significant, you know, thing that historians think about is change over time. And when I look at war memory, I understand it as something that, you know, in 1918, people were remembering World War I in a particular way. 1925, they were remembering it in a different way, and so on through time. And now here we are, 100 years later, also remembering war very differently than it would have been in previous times. So war memory is a way of understanding changes in culture over time, and that's why it interests me. The other reason why war memory is important is because there's a lot at stake in war memory. It's not just a recounting of an event that happened. In fact, when you remember war, you tie into some very critical and important things in national life. One primarily is national identity, right? People remember wars either as victories contributing to a nation's national identity, or defeats that somehow remove from that national identity or take away from that national identity. And so how you remember a war actually has a lot to say about what your national identity is. The same thing is true in terms of questions of morality. How did you behave in the war? The same thing is true in terms of questions of gender. Was war something that was to protect women? Were women protected in the war? Did men act in a manly way in the war, a courageous way? Did they act in a cowardly way? Were they successful? Were they failures? All of these things are tied up in how we remember war. And if you are invested, like many governments are, in maintaining a military that is ready to go and fight the next war, or in our case, in fact, there are several wars that have been continuing, or several military conflicts that soldiers are engaged in. If that is part, and all states have armies mostly anyway, if you have the desire for to mobilize men and resources for war, you have to represent war in certain ways in order to do that. So there's a lot at stake in war memory. And it's always in conflict. This is the sort of the key theoretical underpinning to the work that I do, is war memory changes over time, but people fight over what that memory ought to be also. It's not just that there's this thing called war and people remember it one way. In fact, the events happen, and different constituencies in society, different groups, different people in different places in society remember that war differently. And so there are always, in every case of war, and in every society, contests for meaning over what that war meant. What was that experience? How do we remember the fallen? How do we represent them? And so what I've plan to talk to you tonight about is two different societies and the ways in which they looked at war or didn't look at war, perhaps omitted certain pieces from the narratives of war memory, and struggled in a way with how much they were going to remember about World War I. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about tonight, in these two societies, in the United States and then in the Soviet Union. And what they did in terms of war memories is very different, because the two societies are very different. But nonetheless, there's a certain similarity in that World War I ended up not being a central piece of the mythology of war. When we think of, in the United States, when you think of the good war, when you think of, you know, sort of heroic wars, which are the ones that come to mind?
World War II,
right? World War II is, you know, sort of fundamental to how we think about war. And, you know, very often you go back to World War II. There's also a tremendous amount of, you know, because it was so contested and difficult, there's a lot of remembrance around the Civil War. But World War I, you know, other than the fact that this is the 100th anniversary, had you thought of World War I recently? Yeah, and so that's part of what the, you know, this phenomenon is that World War I is somehow a less remembered war. And so it's very interesting to figure out, well, why is it less remembered? What do we remember about it? And think a little bit about what does it mean when a war is forgotten as opposed to when it's remembered. All right, so Europe doesn't forget World War I. This is the first contrast with both the Russia and the Soviet Union and the United States. In Europe, World War I remains a central, you know, particularly England and France, somewhat in Germany, but especially England and France. World War I remains a touchstone, even despite the fact that World War II was also, you know, sort of more cataclysmic and came afterward. Nonetheless, World War I remains very important in Europe. And here we have, that's the Queen laying a wreath at the cenotaph. The cenotaph is in London. It's an empty tomb. And it gets at one of the key problems of World War I, is that unexpectedly to the combatants, the war was so savage that not all of the, that it was very difficult to have repatriation. Bodies were blown apart. There were. It was difficult logistically to get people home. And so for the first time you have in Europe, and also in the United States, a situation where people have to mourn without the body. And so one of the ways in which the Europeans sort of solved this problem was by creating the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This is a very new thing. And it's because, in part because there was not necessarily a place to mourn. And so this is the kind of central point of mourning in London, and this was built in the early 1920s, and it is there so that people can mourn even in the absence of a body. But as you can see here, this must have been just a couple years ago, maybe even last year, and there's the Queen commemorating the World War I dead. In France, There are kind of layers of monuments here. That's the Arc de Triomphe, right, which is, you know, Napoleonic era wars. But in the Arc de Triomphe, there is a Tomb of the Unknown Soldier for World War I, and a new development. This was from the 1920s when they learned how to lay gas lines underneath the in the city. There's an eternal flame here. I don't know if you can sort of see that. And so that's another, this was something that didn't exist before World War I. The idea that you would have a tomb of the unknown, the idea that you would have an eternal light burning, you know, as a commemoration, this is all very new. But again, here, you have kind of historical layers, because this is a structure that commemorates a previous war, and then the World War I dead are also commemorated in that very same place. So France and England really had the World War I commemoration down and continued to do so. And in fact, this is the most stunning thing. Many of you perhaps have seen this. In honor of the 100th anniversary, they created this sculpture in London. This is the Tower of London. And each of these is a poppy. It's a red poppy, and there are fields and fields. There's 800,000 of these, one for each British man who died in World War I. And this is a really, this is not the best picture. I'm not the best maker of PowerPoints, so you should go online and look this up, and you'll see some very interesting pictures, better than this one. So the idea is a poppy for each person. This comes from the poem in Flanders Fields, where these were the first battlegrounds of World War I, and there were red poppies in the fields, and then people died, and it spilled their blood in the same place. And so the red poppy became very quickly, at the beginning of World War I, the symbol of the dying soldier, and has continued to this day. And so the point here is that in England, in France, there's organized commemoration of World War I, and even though it's 100 years ago, and even though there's not a single living veteran of World War I, nonetheless, it has retained a very important place in British and in French society. But not so much here, and not so much in the former Soviet Union, and now Russia, but we'll talk about that. Okay. If you have questions, feel free to ask. I don't mind stopping along the way. Okay. So this is sort of a basic layout of the there's a very different scale of devastation. In fact, Russia lost more men. More people numerically in World War I than any of the other combatants. In terms of percentage, they didn't, because they had such a big population, but in terms of the actual numbers, they did. In Russia before the revolution, they called it the Great War. After the Russian Revolution of 1917, which was in large part caused by the devastation of the war, they called it the Imperialist War, because they rejected the idea that they should have been fighting in it at all. The Russian revolutionaries completely rejected the war, and so they didn't even, give it a grand name like the Great War. In the United States, it was sometimes called the War for Civilization or the War to End All Wars. How did that work out? Not so good. So the issue, so this kind of gets at the problem of World War I, is that after World War II, it's awfully hard to look at World War I heroically. In part because if the whole point of World War I was to fight a war in order to end wars, and barely 25 years after the end of this war, another far more devastating war breaks out and kills 50 million people in Europe and around the world. Then ultimately, whatever World War I was fought for was fought in vain, right? So after World War II, the idea of World War I changes pretty dramatically, although still is commemorated in Europe more than in the other places. So in Russia, you have 2 million killed, 5 million wounded. It's fairly substantial. It ultimately leads to the revolution and even more upheaval. Between 1914 and 1921, there's an estimated 30 million of excess, so it's either lives lost or people who weren't born. So a population loss of 30 million because of World War I, the Civil War in Russia and the Soviet Union. The United States got off relatively easy compared to it, in part because they didn't come into the war until the very end. They may have come in April of 17, but they're not really fighting on the ground until the last 4 or 5 months of the war. So the war ends pretty quickly after they arrive. Nonetheless, when they do start fighting in the summer and early fall of 1918, the number of killed per day is quite substantial. So it is, there's a good deal of carnage. It's a very brief period in which many people die very quickly, and then the war ends. And so you can see 125,000, roughly speaking, killed. And then right on the heels of that, because of the congregation of people and the movement of troops, World War I enabled the influenza to spread. This was the devastating flu of 1918, which had a much higher mortality rate. And so 30,000 recruits died of influenza, even without ever getting shipped over to Europe, right? They just died in their training camps. And this was part of a massive influenza epidemic that occurred in 1918. So in the United States, the war and the epidemic kind of are together, are in some sense together in people's minds when you think about the costs of that war. Okay, so that's sort of the basic difference. There's a big difference in terms of scale. But nonetheless, that doesn't mean that, you know, the fact is that no matter what, if somebody's lost a loved one in war, whether it's one of a million or one of 125,000, that's still a lost loved one in war. And the society still needs to remember that loss in some way. Okay, so here's how this is the classic Doughboy statue in the United States. There are, I guess we were talking about this, there are three or four of these in Kentucky. They were mass produced. The person who carved it begins with a V, but I cannot think of it, something like that. I apologize for that. I should have written it down. But let's look at our Doughboy. Right, these are statues that were produced. Over 100 of these were made all over the United States, and then there was another sculptor who made statues that were very similar, and so there are even more of this. So if you take a look at him, he's dressed he's very realistically dressed, but he's supposed to be charging out of a trench. Do you think that when you charged out of a trench, you were standing up like that? Probably not. So there's only realism only goes so far. He's got a bayonet. He's got a rifle with a bayonet in one hand. There's barbed wire and other assorted trappings of no man's land here. One of the problems with World War I was that in between the Civil War and World War I, artillery got a lot better. And so none of the combatants really understood how they were going to use this weapon until they started using it. And suddenly everybody was fighting a defensive war, you had to dig in where you were, and anytime somebody tried to make an advance, the other side just took the artillery and mowed them down. So moving forward in the war was almost impossible. And in essence, it was a stalemate for 4 years on the Western Front. But nonetheless, in battles like the Somme and Verdun, each of those is an offensive where one side tried or the other side tried. And basically what would happen is you'd lose a million people and you'd get a few hundred yards. Because there was no way to actually get out of the trenches and advance when the artillery was trained on you. But nonetheless, our Doughboy, you know, the moment that we have is this unrealistic moment where, you know, in fact, millions of people were killed doing just this. But our memorial sort of is that heroic moment where you jump out of your trench and you run across no man's land. And you know this because there's the barbed wire. Furthermore, he's got a grenade, right? Actually, some of the other ones just have a fist, but he's got a grenade. And as one historian who wrote about this, Stephen Trout, pointed out, how can you throw a grenade if you have your rifle? You can't. How do you take the pin out if you have your rifle in one hand and your grenade in the other? It's not right. You do it with your teeth, exactly. But that is not very easy to do, and maybe not even possible. Although it happens in films all the time, so it must be possible, right? So interesting. So this is an interesting moment, right? Because the way in which the sort of classical 1920s way of remembering war is this very heroic guy. And, you know, really, the 125,000 people who died, you know, it's not clear to me that they died in this particularly heroic way. First off, they're, you know, many of them died of influenza, right? But also, I'm not sure if influenza dead are in that 125 or not. I was trying to figure that out. In any case, nonetheless, the image of the soldier is much more heroic than the actual moment of that fight would be. And so he's remembered in this heroic way. And, you know, why is he remembered in that heroic way? Again, because they wanted to valorize the idea of the courageous military hero. And then there's this. This is, yes, it is your Doughboy lamp. And it turns out that in the 1920s, they put a lot of, there was a lot of advertising for Doughboy statues. You could get a 12-inch one to put on your mantle if you wanted, just like the monument. Or you could, these lamps were produced in 1923, you could have your very own Doughboy lamp.
And this gets at, you know, so what are we, you know, what is this commemoration about? I can, you know, is this the heroic soldier? Well, then he's, is he really an accoutrement in your house? Or, how do you square that circle? So it shows a kind of uncertainty about how to commemorate. If you have the simultaneously heroic statue, but then you have it almost, you know, diminished by it becoming a mass-produced object that you plunk on your, you know, you plunk in your house, and so it's a very interesting, it already indicates a kind of discomfort with commemoration and memorialization of the World War I Doughboy. This is another model of the Doughboy, except he's not charging with his hand grenade. This is a cross, and he is saying farewell to his buddy. So he's at the graveside of a friend who's died in the war. And this is a very different image than the doughboy with the grenade. And it too shows that American society in the 1920s is divided about how they're thinking about this war. Right? Some of these monuments emphasize the element of mourning, emphasize the element that war is about loss, and yes, he's a soldier, and yes, he looks pretty fit, and he's got his gun and his bayonet, but he's not being shown at that moment of battle. Instead, he's being shown at a moment of somber reflection as he looks, as he recognizes the cost of war. And so there already you have contestation. That's the fundamental thing that I wanted to, you know, sort of to bring out, is that people don't necessarily agree in the 1920s, and they don't necessarily agree now. Think about the controversy over the Vietnam Memorial, for example. They don't agree how war, or about the World Trade Center Memorial, for that matter. There's lots of different controversies you could come up with. People don't necessarily agree about what war is. They don't necessarily agree about the degree of heroization, and they don't necessarily agree about the form that the commemoration should take. And these two, you know, just kind of the contest between, never mind the lamp, because the lamp is, in some sense, you know, trivializing it, but although he has the, I guess he's got the, is he holding on to, he's, I guess he's got the grenade there, sort of, it's hard to see. But, you know, the difference between that pose and this one, you know, is profound in thinking about what the war means to anybody. And then there's this. People who said, you recognize this building? Did you know that it's a World War I memorial? Yeah. So in the 1920s, people said, we shouldn't waste our money on statues. Right? That's a waste. That's, you know, you're not doing anything with that money if you just put your money into a statue. Let's build a building instead. Let's have what's called a living memorial. Let's make a functional space and have that space be dedicated to the World War I veterans. And so this is the Kentucky State Memorial, World War I Memorial. If you go into the hall, I don't know if you've ever been there, there is county by county a list of who died in World War I inside the... It's not obvious because you're not really looking for it, but it's there. It's on parchment paper. It's not carved. It's just a, you know, kind of a calligraphy, handwritten. But it goes county by county through all of the Kentucky state losses. And so this is on the UK campus if you have not been there. So this is a kind of different take on memorialization. Rather than having an image of a heroic soldier or an image of a mourning soldier. Instead, you take the money that you would have used and commemorate the names in a functional way instead of with statuary that can't be used at all. Okay. Now we're going to move over to Russia. This is my book cover. Before 1917, this was the kind of heroic propaganda that was put together at the beginning of the war. This is a heroic exploit from the first days of the war, where supposedly this fellow with the black horse there killed, he got 11 wounds, but he killed 11 Germans, but he sustained himself, he and his horse sustained numerous wounds, but they nonetheless felled 11 Germans in one day. This is the epitome of the kind of heroic bravado of war. After the Russian Revolution, this is Vladimir Lenin. The idea of World War I was completely rejected. And so there was no official public commemoration inside the territory of the Soviet Union.
that had used to be part of the Russian Empire. There were still some cemeteries and so forth that are now in Poland and Ukraine. But within the territories of the Soviet Union, there was no official commemoration of World War I. And for a long time, people thought that there was no memory of World War I in the Soviet Union. My book makes the argument that, in fact, there was a memory of World War I in the Soviet Union. But I'm gonna kind of glance over that, my argument, pretty quickly here and get to the contemporary Russian moment to compare. The arguments in the book are that people are mistaken, that in fact there was a World War I memory that was actively developing, and that this memory was consistent with some of the European memory that challenged the idea that the war was heroic. And again, it's more like that second, the second doughboy who's looking down at mourning. There are major themes of religion, heroism, violence, and national identity. And here's a good sort of example of an image that emphasizes the horror of war, remembers war as horrible, a moment when masculinity is destroyed, not built up. War as a time when otherwise ordinary people do really amoral, horrible things like rape and pillage. And violence is a part of war, along with ethnic hatred, that gives a very negative cast to what it means to be fighting in war. And I'm going to kind of skip through here. These are some writers. This is a pacifist writer talking about the, you know, sort of the fundamental idea that thou shalt not kill is completely overthrown by war. Here's another memoirist. He's the memoirist is the guy who's looking straight at us here. And he too, these are just some examples from my work. He too talks about war as this obstacle that exterminates culture. According to Vojtilovsky, on every military banner, on the eagles, on the shoulder boards, the secret motto is imprinted, down with culture, long live destitution and the poverty of the spirit. So in the Soviet Union, even though it seems like there was not much war memory, in fact, there was developing this kind of anti-war pacifist ideals that were occurring. This is an Austrian POW camp, but it turns out they often had photographers in the camps. They were trying to, you know, impress upon the Red Cross and everybody else how nicely everybody was being treated. So often you have these nice, you know, I've always puzzled about why they would have this fairly nice picture all posed and everybody in a nice clean uniform and so forth. But this is Peter Levin in an Austrian POW camp. And this is another Sofia Fedorchenko. These are two people who also wrote about the war in very open ways. And give you an example of Levin and Fedorchenko. Levin emphasized that moment that war is not celebrate the heroic body of the male, but actually causes that heroic body to disintegrate. He depicted the despair of a soldier who'd been shot in the genitals and who was, quote, gradually turning into a eunuch. Levin showed this person delicately crying and holding an icon of St. Nicholas to his wounded groin in the vain hope that he might be cured. And this sort of captures the horror of war, the devastation of war, in ways that maybe some of the other materials did not. He also, you know, talks about people who die the most horrible death imaginable of illness and shell shock. On the other hand, Fedorchenko, she was a nurse, and she took down what the soldiers were saying and worked it into a kind of ethnography, but it was really more ethnography and fiction at the same time. And she emphasizes the amorality of war, that once you get into a situation where you're in occupied territories, soldiers have a tendency to do nasty things, primarily pillage and rape, and they talk about this, it talks about taking a woman as war booty. 3 days I kept her with me and amused myself, and I shared her with my platoon commander. Like I would share tobacco, I shared the woman, and then I became afraid and let her go in the field. So there's a kind of immorality there. It emphasizes the dark underside of war. And so war in the Soviet 1930s, in the Soviet 1920s, was talked about in these ways that really challenged the idea that war was heroic, that war was a proving ground on which men could, in which men could prove their honor. Rather, it was a place where honor was destroyed, and very often the physical bodies of the men were destroyed as well. But then, in the 1930s, the war was forgotten. War was forgotten because the Stalinist state was gearing up for a new war.
and they needed
warriors, and they needed to represent war as a very positive thing. So from the 1930s on, there's deliberate censorship of anything that talks about war in a negative way. You can't be afraid in battle, you can't talk about the amorality of war, you can't talk about war wounds, you can't talk about anything like that in Stalinist times. In part because the Stalinist state is trying so hard to mobilize its citizens for the next war. They know the next war is coming. Unfortunately, they're right. And so they don't allow for this idea of war.
One of the things that I wanted to stop, which I meant to do earlier, is talk a little bit about why is World War I forgotten in the United States, right? In the Soviet Union,
I can demonstrate from looking at censorship records. I can show what disappears and when it disappears, and I can show why it disappears. By looking at what is excerpted out, I can see what the state doesn't want said, right? But in the United States, it's a little bit different, right? That is to say, there's no censorship. Nobody says we're not really going to emphasize World War I. But at the same time, there are a couple things that you know, sort of diminish World War I in the American presence. One is, of course, the failure of Wilsonian 14 points. When that is not how Europe behaves, the American public loses some of its appetite when it's clear that disorder in Europe is continuing, when it's clear that England and France have really pushed Germany to the wall, when Germany's economy collapses, also the Russian Revolution is not to anybody's favor. The war kind of creates this swirl of disorder in Europe. Why did we fight this war? If it didn't end all wars, if it wasn't to create a new positive order in Europe, what's the point of it, right? So that's part of what happens. The other thing that happens is as the United States is growing in isolationism, there's also some questions about the how well the World War I soldiers actually did in the war. And as their military performance is being questioned, this also sort of takes some of the luster out of World War I. There continues to be the tension, especially in that first decade after the war, about how to treat African-American veterans. There's traditionally a connection between citizenship and fighting for one's country. When African-American veterans returned to the Jim Crow South, there was a lot of conflict because when they came home and expected to be treated like citizens, and they discovered in many cases that they were not being treated that way, it led to tensions and led to an awareness of the racial inequalities in the United States. So that was another thing that sort of took the luster off the war. Later in the 1930s, when they promised all of the people who lost children in the war, all of the mothers who lost children in war, that they would take them on a trip to the gravesides in the cemeteries in France, or mostly in France, they decided that when the government organized these trips, they segregated them, and the African American mothers had to go on a separate trip than the white mothers. So this also sort of led to this feeling that the war was somehow, what was it fought for? And it unearthed some of these problems and inequalities rather than something to celebrate. Finally, in 1920s, the economics weren't that great, and so when municipalities had to decide how to spend money, a lot of times building a statue wasn't really the first thing on the list, and at the very beginning, there were some monuments that were paid for by tax dollars, and gradually that disappeared, and only private funding was used for these kinds of memorials, and then the Depression hit, and that fizzled out as well. So there wasn't the kind of economic background to this. There was a kind of ambiguity about how people felt about the war, and so it just kind of slides off the radar, shall we say. And so it's a very different reason, but nonetheless, it's a moment where World War I becomes a less centered event.
I want to spend the last few minutes talking about the contemporary moment in Russia and today, because guess what? The Russians discovered what we all are in this room for. 100 years ago, World War I started, right? And so the Russians never celebrated World War I. This is the first World War I monument that was put up in the 90s, only after the fall of the Soviet Union. However, the Russians realized, the Russians right now, as you may know, are very interested in achieving a higher
place in the world by asserting their mastery over other peoples at the moment in Ukraine. And they have been trying very hard since the fall of the Soviet Union to articulate Russian pride. And they realized that they could take World War I and make that an event in Russian pride. Because really, Russia was on the side of the victors, except that it had to leave the war before they won. Right, so there's this idea of the victory was snatched away from them. They had the you know, I think it was Churchill who actually said they were holding the laurels of victory in their hands when they tripped. This was how it was created, imagined. And so, right now in Russia, they are really stepping up their game in terms of celebrating World War I and the centennial for the first time, you know, really in 100 years, because they did not. There were no official civic monuments to World War I at all before 1994. And then, in honor of the 100th anniversary, they decided to build a new one. And they had a contest, and this is the winner. Notice the enormous Russian flag. He can't miss this, that great big Russian tricolor with the double-headed eagle, the Romanov crest on it, right? And it also has a single soldier. Look at him. He kind of looks like the doughboy now that I think about it. You know, he doesn't have his grenade, but you know, he has that soldierly image of the doughboy. What you see too here, and here you have your bayonet charge, right? Never mind that on the Western Front there were hardly any cavalry charges. On the Eastern Front there were a few more, but nonetheless, the quintessential heroic moment of war is the cavalry charge. So let's have a cavalry charge. And then here, this one is quite interesting. It's hard to see, unfortunately, but you have your cavalry charge. And then here, it sort of fades into domestic life. So you have your mother mourning her dead son in the pietà, like the sort of classical pietà pose. And then you have the civilians here, but you also have very prominently the Russian Orthodox Church, and here are the clergy. So these are the elements that are very important in Russian national life today, and voila, they show up on the World War I monument as if they're about World War I. So this is a good example of the fact that World War I memory changes through time, and also that this moment was a propitious one for Putin and the Russian historical commissions to reclaim World War I as a heroic war that they fought in and nearly won, right? Even though in the end it didn't work out so well, they nonetheless were on the winning side. This was the major piece of the commemoration of the 100th anniversary. Putin came and gave a speech at the opening. They collected subscriptions from the population. The city of Moscow kicked in some money, and then the rest of the money came in from donations, and they got quite a large number of private donations to build this. So it's people's monument in that way. That's also a kind of Russian tradition of articulating popular consensus for the state's vision by contributing to the monument. By the way, the monument is placed on a monument park that is mostly World War II monuments, but it does have monuments to other things like the Soviet war in Afghanistan and some other places, but it's primarily the Moscow City World War II Museum. All right, and one last. So this is what Russia did now, right? So you have Russia then, nothing. Russia now is really articulating World War I. We have all those doughboys. Now, what are we doing for World War I in the 100th anniversary? Well, we're here, right? So you can say that you are part of the history we're writing. I don't know if you recognize that building. That's in Moorhead. There was a doughboy on the Moorhead campus, but its pedestal was crumbling. And so they took it off, and they're restoring it. They're restoring the pedestal. And in theory, next week, in honor of Armistice Day, they're going to put the doughboy back and I presume have some kind of ceremony if they're on time. That is the plan. Whether it actually comes to pass is unclear to me. But we do have some, you know, sort of attention to the monuments of World War I more than to the actuality of World War I. Right, so I think in some sense what's happening is the monuments are standing in for, in our community we need to remember this and restore this, but it doesn't seem very connected to a national project or any other kind of project about World War One. In a lot of places, World War One monuments are lost or, you know, or have been removed. Many of them don't remain in the same sites that they were in. So they are, in the United States culture at the current moment, pretty neglected, relatively neglected. And so I want to kind of leave you, I mean, we can open up, but I want to leave you with that thought. You know, here we are. We started out commemorating World War One more strongly than the Soviets. And now, 100 years later, they are articulating a vision of World War One more strongly, and we are not at all. Neither of us are doing anything like what the Europeans in Britain and France are doing. And so both the United States and Russia are alike in being on the margins of this phenomenon. But nonetheless, studying the marginal is always interesting because you get to figure out what the center is like by looking at the margins. Thank you for your attention.
So that was tromping over a long historical period very quickly. I'm very happy to take questions on any aspect of this that you'd like to follow up on.
You know, thinking of talking about commemoration, I grew up in Canada, of course, you have a statue always to World War One. It's usually in the center of the city and mm-hmm. well-preserved and annually commemorated. We were talking at lunch about at the dinner tonight about the tradition of wearing poppies. And mm-hmm. the first picture you showed, of course, the Queen is wearing one.
Yeah.
But that's somewhat been abandoned in the U.S., we're trying to figure out why.
Yeah, but I think it's important. Canada is very distinct, right? Because Canada identified very strongly with the British project of fighting World War One, you know, as part of the British Commonwealth. And so the Canadians and the Australians have very strong memories of World War One because it's connected to that idea of citizenship again. That was their moment when they showed that they could, in fact, be, you know, sort of a strong, independent citizens. And so for Canadians and Australians, it was and continues to be a more important moment. There's a big distinction between Canada and the United States in this regard. I think in the United States there were poppies sort of vaguely in Canada. You know, I mean, there were some, and over the years that has diminished. But it was always stronger in Canada, I would think. I mean, that's my sense of that World War One remains more central in Canada than here. Do you feel that's true?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there are less wars. You just get the sense that you can become war weary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That the public, we've gone through so many wars in the United States lately.
Yeah, I think that is true as well. Yes.
Do you think that it has a little bit to do with the perceived failure of the peace process and the role that we played? Do you think that has a lot to do with the sort of the soured feeling that we have in this country to the First World War?
Yeah, I think you have to, after World War, I mean, when World War II breaks out, then that's, you know, that's the end. But even in the 20s, I think it's clear that, you know, sort of Wilson's vision is not being carried out, that there, you know, that the tensions in Europe are being exacerbated in ways that you know, Wilson did not envision. So yes, I absolutely do. I think that also, you know, also causes the United States to kind of withdraw from, you know, to some degree, or at least there to be a strain of isolationism in that time. So I do think that the overall concern about what are we doing, what were we doing there anyway? What did 125,000 people die for, right? What's, you know, what was the end product of that, of the sacrifice of those men? It's not really clear what it was, right? And because there wasn't a clear answer. You know, in France, they could say they invaded our country. We you know, fought them off, and they're not invading our country. So these are the honored dead who defended their homeland, right? And you know, in England, England is a little bit more complicated, but nonetheless, you could sort of make a claim that they were able to free, you know, sort of the innocent countries of Europe from German invasion, whereas we didn't really have that kind of. You know, what was it, you know, why were you there? You know, why did we get involved? What was it about? You know, and so I think that lack of connection to European activities in the first place made it harder to explain what they were doing. And then the souring of the peace process, the fact that it didn't seem to have succeeded in developing a peaceful Europe also then adds to it a lot. I agree. Yes?
How is currently Ukraine?
That's quite interesting. Well, first off, because current day Ukraine
some of it was actually the battlegrounds of World War One. In fact, that was what I forgot. I forgot to put in my pictures of the World War One cemeteries. There are actual real World War One monuments and cemeteries all throughout Western Ukraine, because that was the very place where the war was fought. And the answer there is, you know, I think that World War One, for at that time, Ukraine was sort of, Western Ukraine was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't part of the Russian Empire, and so that in those borderland places, this war has a very different resonance, because very often what happened in those borderlands is Ukrainians were fighting on one side, Ukrainians were fighting on the other side, Poles were fighting. There was a fratricidal element to it. So they commemorate the dead, because there they are, right in the cemeteries. In fact, we found shells. I mean, there were still this. You know, you can only imagine how much ordnance was used, that there are still shells in the grass today in these, you know, World War One area battlefields in Ukraine. But they're not claiming it as the victory the way that Russia is, right? They're kind of separated out from that. They're not part of that. They're not claiming the Russian imperial mantle. They are much more. They're much more focused on the period afterward, you know, between 1918 and 1921, when Ukraine had its first independent state as a result of the end of World War One. So that's the moment for them. That first burst of independence is the important moment, as opposed to World War One itself. And so I think it is a little bit. It's kind of like, it is like this in the sense that it's a little offhand. It's not really part of the narrative very well, because it doesn't fit well into a Ukrainian national narrative, because in fact Ukrainian people were fighting on both sides. Yeah?
Do you think there's any impact on the memory of the war when you lose that? I would think across the board you've lost an entire generation that served in that. Do you think there's a big impact on the memory there as opposed to World War II, where you still have living there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the passage of time. Yes, I definitely agree with that. That the passage of the last veteran of a war is a milestone moment, because then you have to think about what the next generation, you know, what the next generations are thinking about that war. You know, I think we'll pretty soon be at that point with World War II as well, right? That where no living veteran of the war even exists anymore. And so then, how do you think about that? Now, it's interesting because the U.S. Civil War has retained an active life in memory, despite the fact that the last veteran died, you know, by how many years now? 75 years ago. I mean, I don't even know. I don't know when the last Civil War veteran died, but it's a while ago. So it doesn't necessarily mean the death of the war as the death of the war memory, and in fact, in the Civil War, it has not meant that. But I do think as the generations pass, what that war meant has to mean something. It ends up being much more abstracted. And I think that the one of the interesting things, and this is coming out of World War II, is that the memory of the Holocaust, which has, you know, become very powerful and very important in the 80s and 90s, that came to rise almost as that generation was leaving the stage, although they're not, you know, not quite. And really, in some ways, is about the children of that generation. So I do think that each generation remembers wars differently, but it's not a given that the passing of the generation means the passing of the memory. And so World War One is in particular, it has meant that more for World War One than for some other wars, like Civil War, or for that matter, World War II with the Holocaust. So that's an interesting question. Well, why is it? Why does World War One lack that staying power? And, you know, the argument is because people felt very ambiguously about it from the beginning, and that it never sort of formed a memory that could then be transferred or, you know, sort of developed over time as strongly as some of these other conflicts. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Can I give you an example of that displacement of memory?
Sure.
After World War One, Bowling Green erects this 60-foot Eiffel Tower in the center park downtown.
Oh my.
And it stays there until 1976. And this is a revitalization of downtown. Okay. They decide to move the World War One monument out to the cemetery.
Uh-huh.
So that's a perfect example. As we get further away from the event, you displace that memory.
And it displaced it, and actually literally picking it up and putting it, you know, sort of in this, and putting it in the cemetery where the dead are, rather than in the civic center where citizens remember what's going on. But the, but what's fascinating is it doesn't necessarily have to happen that way. It does happen that way with World War I in the United States, but it didn't necessarily have to. I mean, look at this. I mean, I think this is just, go back to here. I mean, I think this is absolutely breathtaking.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's 100 years after the fact. That's the, you know, the Tower of London, the most ancient, you know, one of the most ancient buildings in London. And, you know, and they chose to, you know, sort of make that this, you know, the pouring of blood of the English soldiers, you know, sort of in this incredibly graphic way, 800,000 handmade red poppies. So yes, what's interesting is some things get displaced, and some things get reinforced. And what's interesting is figuring out which ones get displaced and why, and which ones get reinforced and why. So that's, I absolutely agree with you. I would love to go see the Eiffel Tower in the cemetery next time I come to Bowling Green. I'll try to do that. I have a plan to come in April, so.
Other questions?
I was just going to comment on darn near everything, but I'm just going to let it go.
Well, we can't let you off the hook without telling us a bit about your thoughts about the current struggle in Ukraine.
In Ukraine. Yeah, I addressed it a little bit, but okay. So Ukraine is, in some ways, I'm a historian and not a political scientist. Political scientists are supposed to predict things, right? And I don't know that I or anybody else saw this Ukrainian situation coming. And it came to me out of the blue, and it came as a sort of shock, because the idea of plucking, you know, just saying, okay, I think I'll take that slice of your country, thank you very much, you know, it seems so out of step with contemporary, you know, sort of ideas of international legality. But I think it stems back to this idea of, after the fall of the Soviet Union, all of the Soviet Union broke into 15 different countries. Russia had always considered itself the sort of leader of, you know, in some sense they were an imperial power within the Soviet Union. And then they spent basically 20 humiliating years with, you know, not with everything being in disorder, with people being plunged into poverty, people being plunged into, you know, sort of losing national pride. These embarrassing moments at the Olympics, and you know, when in 1992, when they had 94, where they had to play the Olympic hymn because there were no national anthems. You know, there was a kind of a period of national disgrace in a way for the Russian state. To my mind, the Ukrainian situation is a response to that. It's saying, hey, wait a second, we're still here, we're strong. We, you know, sort of, we're Russian, and we're going to take care of the welfare of all of the Russian-speaking people in our region. And Crimea, in fact, is, you know, 85 to 90% Russian-speaking, and you know, many of the people in Crimea did consider themselves Russian. And it was almost randomly assigned to Ukraine in the 1950s, mostly because of it's a lot easier to supply it with oil and food through Ukraine than through Russia. So Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine. But at the same time, the fact that you have a lot of Russian speakers in a place does not justify taking it over. Rather, it's this idea of national pride that made Putin want to flex his muscles in a way that reinforced national identity and reinforced, hey, those are Russians in Crimea, and therefore we, Russia, have to be in charge of them. And you know, the same is true in eastern Ukraine. There are certainly swaths of people who are Russian-speaking there. But where it's going to end is a mystery to me. You know, will he, having taken these pieces out of Ukraine, be satisfied? The people in Kiev are afraid that he's going to march on Kiev, you know, that he's just going to try and take more. I have no way of knowing, you know, sort of what's going to happen, but I do tie it much more strongly to this idea of national humiliation than to, you know, sort of logistics. So it doesn't really, it doesn't make much sense to do this except as a nation-building exercise. And he certainly made his popularity skyrocket because his Russian, you know, sort of population are very excited at the idea of sort of reintegrating the Russian populations back into a Russian state.
Even if they can't celebrate Halloween, right?
Even if they can't celebrate Halloween. And, you know, the media is pretty controlled in Russia, so what people think is a little bit murky because maybe they wouldn't like what they knew, but maybe they wouldn't like it if they knew all of the facts.
Well, it's now time for the door test. You'll bring the box, Jennifer.
All right.
We have a copy of Professor Patron's book to give away tonight.
And the lucky person is Jenny Montgomery.
Jenny? Congratulations.
Oh, me. I was clapping for her, though.
And on behalf of WK Libraries, on behalf of our WK Owensburg folks, who put on this wonderful show, Kevin, I want to thank you. And a little token of our appreciation to our speaker, Karen.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Jennifer, we want to invite them to join in the reception at the end. And again,
it's beautiful.
Thank you, especially for coming out on a rainy evening. And I hope you can come away with some interesting memories about World War I. Thank you, and good evening.
Thank you.